Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
My mom, I think, met my father at a Duran Duran concert of some or something of that sort. Was a whoopsie child. Things happen. I happened. And, yeah.
Do I have this right? You mentioned that you're named after a certain rock personality.
Yes. The breath of Australia's 80s new wave in excess. So my first name, Michael, is after their former lead singer, Michael Hutchins. And my middle name, John, J-O-N, is after their drummer, John Ferris. So suffice to say, my mom was a huge fan of NXS at the time.
So you're like the love child of Duran Duran and NXS. You have this stuff in your blood.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're tuned to Sound Effect. And this gentleman, who was raised on 80s and 90s new wave, is 30-year-old Michael Henriksen. In high school, Michael was not into this music. He was more into new metal and hip-hop. But that changed when he walked into a piano bar in Minnesota and heard the angelic voice of Debbie Gibson.
Now only in my dreams. Yeah, I just remember people would get up and dance, and I'm like, oh God, what is the breath of this music that I have never been exposed to before? Yeah, I don't know, something about it's very infectious, it's makes you want to dance, get up, it's very unique to a time period, and I guess with having that blood relation to NXS, it just came out in me.
Michael was all in, diving deep into 80s music. Along the way, he picked up a special fondness for one particular artist, Billy Idol. Michael saw him live a few times, including a show at Tulalip Casino just north of Everett. And something about that show left kind of a sour taste in his mouth.
I remember being very irked by the fact that one of my favorite artists was playing at a casino. It just makes you think like, oh man, you're way bigger than this. You could be playing, you know, more prestigious venues like a Paramount or a more theater of that case. And something about that kind of ticked me off that I needed, ticked off like not in a bad way, but ticked off in an idea sort of way that maybe I need to look into this a little bit.
So you saw that Billy Idol show and you got the spark of an idea inside somewhere. What was the idea?
Yeah, to get Billy Idol to come play at my birthday party. I think, I mean, when you say that, you're like, okay, was he playing in your kitchen? You know, I felt if I could get him to play a public show in Seattle, you know, at any sort of venue with no budget, mind you, I'm not of any wealth. How can I accomplish this? And I think it was not just the Billy Idol idea kind of coming into my head. There was a lot of things happening in my life right out of college. And it's like, man, I'm $40,000 in debt. I'm selling board shorts at Billabong in Bellevue Square, and I can't even get a full-time job with this diploma that is in my hands that's costing me so much money. And I was at the age, too, where people get married, moving across the country. So it occurred to me after I saw Billy Idol at that Tulalip show, how do I further my professional career and get over this hump of people saying, no, you know, we're not going to take you on as an intern? How do I get all my friends in one place, and how do I do something that's sort of never been done before?
At first, Michael got the same answer he would get when he would go apply for jobs and internships. No. But Michael just decided he wasn't going to accept that. Instead, he'd work at it for 2 years, determined not to take no for an answer. And that's what today's show is all about. People who hear the word no and just keep plugging away anyway. We'll meet an undocumented student who refuses to back down just because her university told her to. And we'll go sailing with a man who is legally blind and determined to captain his own boat, even though the world is telling him no. We'll hear those stories in a bit, but for now, back to Michael and his quixotic quest to get Billy Idol to play at his birthday party. So first step, create a website.
So I had to get content for the website. So I went out and I bought a video camera. I need to get celebrities involved. People love celebrities. So I had a friend that worked at the Parlor in Bellevue, the comedy club, and I asked her if she could sneak me after the show to go meet Kevin Nealon of Saturday Night Live fame. And my introduction to him was, hey, huge fan. Could you do me a solid and tell Billy Idol on camera to come play at my birthday party?
Billy Idol, Kevin Nealon, you got to come to Seattle next October to do Michael's birthday. It's going to be awesome.
I think they're so caught off by what you're asking, they just figure, okay, why not? And I would send out a mass BCC email about, hey, why does Apollo Anton Ono and Ron Jeremy want Billy Idol to come play this local Seattle kid's birthday party?
So here you are. You're slowly but surely cobbling together this list of, I don't want to say like A minus
level. You can say level. C plus Fabio. Where do you rank Fabio?
Did you really get Fabio?
Yeah, we got Fabio.
What?
Funny story. He was selling his protein powder at the Whole Foods in Inner Bay.
Do me a favor. You know, Mike was a great guy, and, you know, I'm having this big party, and can you do me a big favor? Can you come up in Seattle, and let's have some fun, and I'll join you, and we can really have some great time.
The ball kept rolling with celebrities, and I could tell the local media was certainly jumping on the bit to see who I'd get next, and that's when I finally heard from Billy Idol's management about a year into the project. And I remember getting a phone call from Tony Dimitrakis, who works with East End Management. And they also rep like Tom Petty and the Beach Boys. And obviously I was freaking out on the other line of the phone. And he's like, you know, why are you doing this? What are you trying to get out of this? What do you want? And, you know, I told him, look, I'm in debt. I can't seem to find work in a field that I love. And I want to do something outside of the box and something different. It felt at the time that they were just trying to, hey, let's acknowledge him and let's see if he goes away. And that kind of sparked me to do more. So I came up with Billy Idol Aid, which was a spinoff of Live Aid. And we eventually did four events and raised over $17,000 for Northwest Harvest, which is a local food bank here in Seattle, and for the American Red Cross. And I created a band called Nightwave off of Craigslist. Certainly turned some heads when we had about 1,000 people show up for a cover band that had only played one show before.
You brought in 1,000 people to go watch?
Almost 1,000. I think 900 or so people ended up coming to this Billy Idol Aid 2 event. Billy Idol at the second Billy Idol Aid event sent a video, which you know, was him acknowledging the project a year into this thing, which was certainly like mind-blowing.
By any reasonable sort of person's appraisal, you won already. Like this, yeah. This should be the climax of the story.
Yeah, but I took a step back and said, you know, this was not the goal of the project. The goal of the project was not to get a 20-second video from Billy Idol. The goal of the project was to get him to come play a concert.
What was the next development then?
I got a call about a week out from Billy's management team saying, hey, we're going to send you a video to show at this final Billy Idol Aid. We don't want to give anything away, but we'll send you it about 2 days beforehand and you can show it at the show. I'm like, okay, what does this mean? By some sort of miracle, AEG Live, which runs the Showbox venues, had come to an agreement for Billy Idol to come play a show because of this project on October, I believe 25th or 26th of 2012 at Showbox Soto. And I remember getting the call. I was at work at the time at Bellevue Square, and I just sprinted outside of the mall and just freaked out.
So the idea was that he wasn't going to show up at the Billy Idol Aid 4 show. He was going to send a video announcing the
Correct.
October show.
Okay. Yeah. So he sent this video. So again, my band Nightwave had played the show, and so yeah, we got off stage. They played the video. I tried to tell as many people to be quiet so they could hear what was being said, since there was no text on a screen. And you know, it's Billy Idol saying, all right, untwist your knickers, we're doing it. We're coming to Seattle at the Showbox Soto.
For what is sure to be one of the most memorable birthday parties your city has ever known.
And then from there, it was just an absolute whirlwind. I mean, the show went on sale that night, sold out in 2 days. You know, CNN comes calling, Good Morning America, the BBC, the Today Show in Australia, every local radio morning personality in the United States. And I had no idea.
Was
at the
that
time.
Fun, or was it just bewildering, or what was it like?
In a short spurt, thrilling. Like, yeah, how cool to be able to live that life for a week. But long term, I have no idea how anyone in their right mind that has that sort of celebrity status, you know, does it.
So what was it like to actually meet the man?
Yeah. So after all that, after 2 years, I really only got to talk to him for about like 2 minutes tops. They had a row of cameras lined up and they're like, okay, we're going to have you meet Billy now. You can tell he's kind of hamming it up for the camera.
All right. Yeah. We're here in Seattle. All right. We're doing it. This is great. All right.
So it was a little awkward. I didn't know what to say, but yeah, we talked for 90 seconds. I mean, the interview's up on YouTube and I shake his hand nervously a bunch of times. It's so awkward.
Thank you so, so much from the bottom of my heart for coming out here with your band. And it's been a crazy
show. Was kind of a blur. I was in the crowd, but then people kept pulling me aside, wanted to take photos. I'm like, this is not the way to enjoy a concert after 2 years of trying to get this to happen. So here we are 5 years later, and we're still sort of talking about it.
Well, what do you feel like you learned from this experience about not taking no for an answer?
There's so many points in this project where it would be very easy for me to say no and to stop the project, whether it had been my girlfriend saying, hey, I need more of your time, or whether it be Billy Idol sending me an initial video saying, hey, great job, way to raise so much money, or whether it was, you know, 1,000 people at the Shellbox for a cover band no one knows about. There's so many points where you could stop and say, my God, I'm so lucky, I'm so blessed to have this happen to me. But there's just something to be said about, you know, creating a goal and doing everything that you can to achieve that.
Yeah. If you could meet, let's say, another standout 1980s pop star, who would it be?
If I could meet one?
Yeah. Invite one to come over
so
for breakfast.
Many. I'd say probably, if I say one band, probably Duran Duran.
Dear Duran Duran, Michael Henriksen was conceived because of your show.
It's true.
You're the reason for him, and I think you should probably come to Seattle and play a breakfast show.
Yeah, you hear that, Simon LeBon?
Well, Michael Henriksen works in marketing at UW Medicine here in Seattle. And about 5 years ago now, he had Billy Idol come and play his birthday show. And your birthday is coming up in October, right? Happy birthday.
Yeah, it's October 22nd.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
And Michael Henriksen's devotion to 80s and 90s pop music is undiminished. To learn about his latest quest to be the opening act for New Kids on the Block, go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. Today we're telling stories about not taking no for an answer. In this next story, we are going to introduce you to Mohammed Farid. He's a recent transplant to Seattle, and he loves to sail.
It's a very relaxing way of doing stuff because you have the water, you have the wind. I actually also enjoy some of the engineering concepts behind it.
Mohammed took a class at a local sailing club to learn how to operate a type of boat called a keelboat. And he passed all the tests, but the sailing club still will not let Mohammed captain a boat alone. They're concerned about his safety because Mohammed is legally blind. Taking along another sailor might seem like a pretty reasonable compromise, but not to Mohammed. He wants to be his own captain. Sound Effect contributor Heba Fisher has the story.
Mohammed Farid recently moved to Seattle from Dubai. He's 30 years old, tall, with dark brown hair and thick glasses. He has a dry sense of humor, cracking jokes easily between English and Arabic. And Mohammed can see light, but not a whole lot else.
I will see around 10% of what the normal person sees, but it's almost like you are looking through a tunnel. I can only see in the middle, and there's stained glass at the end of the tunnel because that 10% is more blurry.
Because of his visual impairment, he's used to hearing, no, you can't do that, a lot.
When I'm told I cannot do it, it makes me want something more. I just don't like basically hearing no for an answer.
He's been rejected from engineering school because they didn't believe a visually impaired person could become an engineer. He was rejected 3 times from Harvard, 2 times from the top consulting firm McKinsey, from gym memberships who felt he was too much of a liability. Today, Mohammed is an engineer, graduated from Harvard, worked at McKinsey, and is a regular at the gym. He gets this can-do philosophy from his mom, Dua Mabrouk.
And she wasn't very impressed because they were telling her that, like, yeah, I'll probably not really achieve anything and whatnot. They should probably just save up money so I could be, like, comfortable when I'm older and unemployed. So she was like, I'm not taking any of this, and she went to Canada.
Mohammed spent most of his childhood in Canada. There, however, the services for visually impaired children weren't that great either.
Whereas in Egypt, there were no services and no expectations. In Canada, there was a lot of services and low expectation for independence. Their assumption was that you could strive for mediocrity and that's totally acceptable, which my mom did not agree with.
In Canada, Dua found some like-minded teachers who believed Mohammed's abilities were far greater than any disability. One teacher used to give him a weekly spelling test, but because reading wasn't visual for Mohammed, spelling was harder for him.
Every time I failed the spelling test, she'd give me detention, despite the fact that in some ways you could argue it was out of my control. Her thing was, life's unfair, you have to deal with it.
Mohammed moves through life with determination. He's unfazed by obstacles, like being the captain of a 27-foot sailboat. In sailing, there are 2 basic types of boats, dinghy boats and keel boats. Dinghies are smaller, maybe fitting 1 to 4 people. Keel boats are much larger boats. Mohammed is an experienced dinghy sailor from his time in Dubai. He loves being out on the water, and when he moved to Seattle last year, he signed up for keelboat sailing classes.
I actually scored pretty highly on the exam, both the practical and the written part. The instructor doesn't actually get how I managed to do man overboard properly, but it worked. And then they were like, we prefer it if you had a certified sailor with you, someone who is basically equivalently certified on the boat.
And what do you think should be the case?
I don't think putting it as a longer term thing makes sense. I think if someone is sighted and is able to communicate to me, if I'm going to hit something, I think it's more than sufficient.
Mohammed says this extra person doesn't need to know how to sail. He understands the sailing club is trying to be safe by requiring another certified sailor be on board, but he really believes he'll be okay without one. Now, I recently got my keelboat certification, so Mohammed and I go out sailing one day after work.
Well, okay, let me just look around. I just want to figure out the overall layout of the boat. So this is it's a tiller. Where's the motor, or is this inboard?
Inboard.
Okay.
We're 4 on the boat. Mohammed is our designated captain. He's learning the boat with his hands, and we are his eyes.
Okay. So I think the last 2 things left now are the engine, and then we can basically undock.
It's one of those precious Seattle summer afternoons, sunny and slightly crisp on the Puget Sound. As we motor away from the dock, Mohammed is at the tiller, driving.
I need someone to tell me if I'm going to like bump into something, whether which way I need to go, left or right or whatnot. Where's the motorboat? What?
Starboard.
He's a nice guy. He waved at us.
He's like, what the heck?
After a few close calls, we get to open water, ready to raise our sails and shut off the motor.
So I will face the wind.
Wait, one step. How did you point us into the wind?
I can feel the wind coming into my face. You can actually tell it from your ears if when I'm looking in towards one direction, if I hear the wind in both ears, that's the direction the wind's coming from, which now is like 10 o'clock. Okay, awesome. Now we are sailing. Most beginners, when they sail, they look at the sail, figure out whether the sail is flapping or not. most advanced sailors don't actually necessarily have to look at the sail when they're sailing. And in my case, I can't look at the sail when I'm sailing. So in order to solve that problem, I need to feel the boat. I feel how much the boat is heeling, or like how much it's leaning, how fast it's going. I can listen to the sail.
I think I need to sheet in the jib. It's flapping.
People think because they wouldn't know how to do something the way I do it, that it's, you can't do it the way I do it.
Do you ever just get tired, though, that you constantly have to prove to people as opposed to them just believing it from the get-go?
Yeah, sometimes it wears on you, but that's okay. That's something in my life. I'm used to that.
All of this, working towards being the captain of his own keelboat, it's not actually just about sailing for him. It's about Muhammad's pushing back on the world to be as independent as possible, free from having to rely on others, free from being dependent on other people.
Okay.
For now, Muhammad will have to have a certified sailor with him when he wants to sail these larger boats. But he's confident he'll be his own captain someday.
Heba Fisher is a producer based in Bellevue. You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories about people who won't take no for an answer. We've been hearing a lot lately about the so-called dreamers, young people who were brought illegally into the U.S. as children. These are the people who have been shielded from deportation by the DACA program, a policy begun under Barack Obama and now targeted for elimination under President Donald Trump. Anna Ramirez has a pretty complicated relationship with DACA and with her own school. She's a sophomore at Western Washington University in Bellingham, and you might say that she and they are in a battle of wills. Anna was born in Mexico, but she grew up in OMAC in Eastern Washington, and she didn't actually know she was undocumented until she was 14 years old.
I was invited to study abroad in Europe. And I was really excited, and I told my parents, and they told me that I couldn't go, and I didn't know why. And then they told me that I couldn't go because I wasn't born in the U.S., and I knew what that meant, that I wasn't a U.S. citizen.
And do you remember what that felt like?
Yeah, it was very confusing because I had never, like, thought about it. Like, I came to the U.S. when I was 6 months old, so I always considered myself American.
In the middle of all this, Anna became eligible for DACA. She applied in May and was waiting for approval when President Trump announced the program would end. She had wanted to apply earlier, but during the election, with the fate of immigration policy still up in the air, lawyers recommended that she not hand over her information to the government just yet. After President Trump took office, things changed. Anna did not want to hide from the government anymore.
And I joined the Blue Group, which is the undocumented student club here at Western. And we started, like, going to city council, demanding that Bellingham became a sanctuary city.
How did that feel then, to go from keeping it all as private as possible to being almost as public as possible with it?
It took a long time because I was too scared to even be in the room where people would know that I was undocumented.
After the presidential election, Anna decided to run for office herself. She campaigned for vice president for governmental affairs at Western. She came up with a platform, put up posters, and then election night rolled around.
Oh my gosh, I was so nervous. I was with some friends. Like, I was really scared. I didn't think I was going to win. And I was just waiting for my phone to ring, and they called me. I literally could not believe it. And then I was like crying.
What did that mean to you?
It really meant a lot to me. It meant that, like, I could do things despite my immigration status. I'm, like, the first undocumented student in student government here at Western.
So let's fast forward a little bit. As you're kind of working your way towards starting your term, what happened?
I got an email from a university official because I was supposed to be on a committee. They said that they had, like, removed me from this committee. And this was, like, the first time that I had, like, had anything said to me. And so I, like, had to, like, email other university officials. And someone from Human Resources scheduled a meeting with the Assistant Attorney General for Western. And he told me that, like, I wasn't in a legal position to be able to take the Vice President for Governmental Affairs position. And I remember on June 19th, which was the first day, I showed up because we had a board of directors meeting. And it was about me. It was to talk about me. So, you know, obviously I want to be in a board of directors meeting because I sit on the board of directors and they're going to talk about me. And they removed me from the meeting because they said that I wasn't technically in my position.
Did you put up a fight?
Not really. I left and I went to the office of the Undocumented Student Advisor, and then I sent out my press release and I went public.
How were you feeling when they did that?
I was so mad. I was like, how dare he? But yeah, it was mostly just disbelief, I guess, because he told me that I wasn't in this position, even though I am. I'm literally wearing the name tag. You know, like, everyone recognizes me as a vice president for governmental affairs, except for the administration.
Why didn't you accept that then?
Well, I'm not going to let them stop me. Like, this is my position. Like, it's mine. But they had already told me no, like, multiple times. At first, I asked if I could run. I said, I don't have DACA. Can I run in the elections? And they were like, no, you shouldn't. And I did anyways.
And just to be clear, why is it that if you can be a student here as an undocumented immigrant, why can't you serve in student government? What's the difference?
Because they don't have DACA. They said that it's federal money, so they can't pay me.
So those are paid positions, those student government jobs.
Yeah, they're paid positions.
The university says that if they were to pay you with these federal funds, that then they would expose themselves to legal action, that they would get in big trouble. So what do you make of that argument? Okay.
Well, I met with the Assistant Attorney General, and one of my professors asked, like, what is the penalty if Western does pay her? And he said that it would be a $250 fine. So they're telling me that I'm not even worth $250 to them. And my professors offered, they were like, oh, like, we'll pay the fine if it's only $250.
Have you been tempted to give up, bail on this whole thing, and go back to, like, regular life?
Yeah, I've been really tempted. Like, I don't even want this position, like, that much. But, like, this isn't about me anymore. Like, it's something bigger. It's more about how undocumented people are treated, how citizenship affects everything. It shouldn't, and I'm not going to let it, you know?
What did your family think of it?
Honestly, my family doesn't know a whole lot about this. Like, my parents knew I applied for DACA, and they knew I got this position.
Why haven't you talked to them about it?
I know that my parents are going to be happy that I, like, went public. Because my parents wouldn't let me do, like, activism or anything like that. Even talk about being undocumented. Because, like, where we're from in Eastern Washington is kind of, like, the place. Like, if people find out you're undocumented, like, they'll call ICE. So, obviously, I grew up never talking about it. Like, I never told anyone. I think my parents are just really, like, scared that, like, it'll, like, draw attention to me and then, like, ICE will, you know, show up.
Are you scared?
Not really. I know that it's, like, a possibility, but it's worth the risk, I guess.
So you have a little brother, right?
Yeah, I have a younger brother. He's 17. He was born here, so he's a U.S. citizen.
Does he know what you're up to now?
Yeah, he knows. Like, we don't really talk about it. I think it's been hard for him.
Why?
This is, like, the first time that I've, like, been away from my family. And then, like, it has to be like this. We were like scared all the time.
So how often do you feel that way?
I try not to think about it.
If your DACA status comes through, will that just solve the problem? And if so, is that okay?
Yeah, I will just solve the problem with the AS, the Associated Students. But I'm not okay with that because they just see DACA as the answer and it's not. And there's a lot of people who don't even qualify for DACA. But like in the future, what if some other undocumented student that doesn't qualify for DACA, like, wants to be in this position and you're going to tell me like they can't? I'm not okay with that.
So if that happens, you're going to keep raising a ruckus?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anna Ramirez is a sophomore at Western Washington University. The uncertainty around the DACA program adds new wrinkles to her already unpredictable future, but she still has her own plans. Someday, she wants to run for Congress. Welcome back. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today on Sound Effect, our theme is Won't Take No for an Answer. Trisha Arcaro Turton's career started with a big fat no.
There was a poster, maybe like at the local Elks Club or something. They had a Golden Gloves poster, so I said to my dad, "Dad, I want to do the Golden Gloves." And he just kind of laughed at me, put his hand on my head, and was like, I have a childhood nickname, Schmitty. He goes, "Schmitty, girls can't box." So I thought to myself, what a stupid sport. You know, what a dumb sport that girls can't do it. So I kind of disdained it for a while, wouldn't really watch it with them on TV or anything. It really pissed me off, and now I own a gym.
Mix up the power, Kevin.
Trisha says she was never one to be discouraged just because someone tells her she can't do something. So she underwent grueling training and eventually became a professional boxer. She'd rack up 8 wins and 4 losses before she retired in 2005. So these days she trains boxers, men and women, professional and newbie alike. And she tries to teach her students to face themselves in the ring, the way that she had to as a rookie and still does today. We met up at her gym in Seattle's First Hill and talked about what sports have meant to her over the years.
I loved competing. It was the most alive I ever felt was when I was being physical, doing sports and competing. Nothing could distract me. That was just it. Really single-minded focus. I loved that.
And you found your way into some pretty physical sports. Do you gravitate toward the really physical sports, you think?
I must. I don't think I consciously chose it. You know, I'm only 5'5".
Which is really tall, in my opinion.
Thank you. Oh, God bless you. I thought I wanted to be an Olympian on the basketball team. And first of all, I couldn't even get my emotional self together to go to college. And so, you know, playing for D1 wasn't going to happen. After being lost for a little while, I found rugby, and I took to it. It took to my body type. And I just really found my way, and I made the U.S. team, and I played on the World Cup in 98, and just never looked back. It was an incredible sport, and then I started doing boxing for fitness, and I got hooked.
What can you tell me about what your life was like in your early 20s and what kind of struggles you were dealing with?
I think I felt pretty lost. I didn't know who I was, what I was doing. I was a grinder. I had a very intense work ethic. But I also had an intense party ethic, too. I partied hard. I drank hard. I tried lots of different drugs. I never missed work. I always went to work on time. And that was sort of my only way I knew who I was. And I had no sports in my life, so I just didn't have anything really kind of going for me. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was really mad at the world.
Wait, what were you mad at?
I don't know. What aren't you mad at when you're like 20 and you come from a split home and you're trying to find your way? I think I was just mad at a lot of things. I was just talking to my stepmom about this. I said to her, "Man, we were pretty poor, and I realized that you guys were really stressed and just trying to do the best you could." And no joke, they used to pick us up by our armpits and put us in a dumpster to pick out aluminum cans. My dad worked 3 jobs. He would do side gigs like we'd clean Greyhound buses. So my brother and I would help clean Greyhound buses. I think I was mad a little bit because, first of all, growing up female in the 70s, you're told you can't do a lot of things. And it didn't make sense to me because I did whatever I wanted. And I was estranged from my mother. I was just really mad. I didn't know who my mom was, and I didn't know who I was.
So you were playing rugby at a pretty high level, elite rugby on the U.S. team for some years. And then how did you transition from that into boxing?
A buddy of mine I played rugby with, she had told me about it, and I went. I did the fitness class. I liked it, but saw these people putting on headgear and watched the sparring a little bit. I thought, man, I want to try that. And I tried it. I really liked it. I was really bad at it, and it made me mad, and I wanted to be better at it. And
Wait, say more. Tell me, what do you remember about that first time?
I remember getting hit a lot.
Were you not expecting that?
No. I'm kind of cocky. Thought I was a good athlete. Thought that I could, have my way in there, and that was definitely not the case.
What's it feel like to get punched, like those first few times?
I took everything really personal. I thought there was something wrong with me. Why were they taking whatever was with them out on me? Everything was really, really personal, which is not the case in boxing, but when you first start it can feel that way. I felt powerless. I felt extremely powerless. It was unbelievable. I felt like I had no way to defend myself, no way to be effective.
So walk me through how you started to confront that.
I think a lot of self-awareness. I had already started exploring Buddhism, and I really want to know who I am. As a kid, I used to look in the mirror, and I used to stare at myself and ask myself, who are you? You know, like, what are you doing? And, you know, why are you here? And I think boxing started to give me the answers more so, or through boxing, I got the answers in my life, more why I'm here and what I'm doing.
So this is really interesting, because, I mean, a lot of people who might not understand boxing or be interested in boxing would think maybe this is a way of avoiding stuff. You know, you're avoiding your own emotions, you're avoiding what's inside of you because you're just going out and you're hitting stuff. It seems violent in that way. But that seems very much not how you think of it.
I don't think about it like that at all. I mean, I'm not oblivious to the violence of hitting somebody. I take it seriously. But more importantly, I'm looking at the harm that would come to folks that continue living their life the way they do if they didn't start facing themselves. And that to me is much more harmful than a few punches to the head.
So speaking of, you know, being brave enough to look stupid or do something that you're bad at. So I took a boxing lesson in the last 6 months or so, actually, for the first time. And I'm really glad there's only one other person in the gym there to see me. It was fantastically embarrassing. But, you know, I did that, I think, for a lot of the reasons you're talking about. This is interesting to me because I did it, I think, because it was one of the most out-of-character things I could think of to do for myself. And I was curious if I could still do something that was out of character. To be honest, I haven't wandered back into a boxing gym. So what would you say to somebody like me?
I'd say come be uncomfortable again. It won't be like the first time, I guarantee. You will never be the same amount of uncomfortable. I mean, it's no secret that you have to go out of your comfort zone to learn. You're not gonna die. Maybe your ego a little bit, and it'll build up again.
Tricia Arcaro-Turton owns Arcaro Boxing in Seattle, where I may someday go to get punched in the face. We close out the show today in Olympia, Washington.
Should I turn the fans off?
No, it's okay.
Okay. So this is the A dorm, and this is a men's dorm.
Meg Martin is giving me a tour of the Interfaith Works Emergency Overnight Shelter. It's in the basement of an older church downtown.
Our shelter is a low-barrier shelter, which means that we try to make it as easy as possible for people who really need shelter to get in the door. And so one of the main parts about that is that we allow couples to stay together.
Meg got into this work after moving here from Montana in 2007. She was recovering from addiction, and she threw herself into outreach work for a program that uses bicycles to deliver clean needles to addicts.
It just completely changed my life. And I just really started seeing the realities of what life was like for people on the street and getting to know them. You know, one person was an architect for the city of Olympia forever, and just all these stories of like, wow, you've been here for so long contributing to this community, and like, yet here you are again on a rainy night eating cold pizza from the back of a bike trailer because there's no other options for you.
Then local officials began adopting so-called quality of life ordinances, rules that outlaw panhandling or lying down on the sidewalk. To Meg, that was basically making homelessness a crime, but without giving people an alternative. So she and some friends cooked up the idea of a shelter, one that doesn't impose restrictions on people with addictions or mental illness. She would soon find out that a lot of people, even in progressive Olympia, did not want that population in their neighborhoods. Still, Meg would just not relent. To her, the status quo wasn't cutting it.
The shelters that we did have available were running at pretty low occupancy. And the reason for that was because the programs were so rigid that people with complex challenges related to their physical health, their mental health, and their substance use related health failed every time. And so
it was like, you can stay here, but you have to be clean. You have to be, you know, follow the schedule. In some cases, you have to go to maybe some kind of religious service or something like mm-hmm. that. So a lot of requirements.
And also there's, you know, required savings account stuff where you have to give 85% of your income to your case manager. And if only you could manage your money better, then maybe you wouldn't be homeless. If only you could get sober, then maybe you wouldn't be homeless. But it's completely ignoring the societal role where there's no jobs to get. And even if you saved up for first and last month's rent, we have a less than 3% vacancy rate in Thurston County, and average rents are over $1,000 a month now in Olympia.
So how did the city and the other kind of powers that be react when you explained what you wanted to do, to open up this low barrier shelter?
So it was mixed on the city council. There was some folks that were really hesitant. There were other folks that really got it, that had known about the Housing First movement, knew that we needed to bring it to Olympia, and were willing to kind of go out on a limb for us. And they helped us secure some modest funding from the city, and then they encouraged us to go to the county. And that year, the county, there was this wild thing that happened where they had this bubble fund of an extra $1 million that they couldn't spend in the year previous. And so we were able to get startup funds for the shelter. So the money that we got, though, was contingent upon finding a location that was, quote, agreeable to the city of Olympia, unquote. And so that's when things got really interesting.
This was kind of a wall you hit.
The message became that we were going to be a shelter for sex offenders, drug addicts, and felons. And there was a large community effort that mounted against us, particularly when we were looking at one location that was located next to a local Catholic church that has a K-12 school as part of it. The neighborhood just exploded. They brought all their best organizing to organize against us. There was a mailer that went out at one point to that neighborhood that included two photos of convicted sex offenders and said, you know, this certain candidate wants these two guys to move into your neighborhood. Are you okay with that? It was just that pounding that message of sex offenders, drug addicts, felons, sex offenders, drug addicts, and felons. And at that point, we completely lost control of the message and of the narrative. But what I learned is that I really needed to figure out how to listen. Where is their fear? Where are they at? How can I try to meet them there to build bridges? And we just had our annual dinner in January, and there was about 200 people there. And one of the moms that had spoken out actually against us in that public forum is now on my fundraising and events committee.
And so this involved a lot of campaigning. I mean, you had to go speak before city council many, many times, right? And you, what was it that the mayor called you? You kind of a reputation.
Yeah, graciously tenacious, I believe, is what it was.
So after all those challenges and all the work and the years of planning, what was it like to finally open the doors?
I remember we got the beds all in here, and I just completely broke down. And it was probably sleep deprivation and all kinds of stuff, but I just was like, I can't believe we even have to do this. I can't believe that this is the best we can do. There was just something about it that was this like truly heartbreaking moment where I was like, what world are we living in?
Wow. So you achieved this elusive goal, and the feeling at that moment wasn't elation. It was, why did we have to do this in the first place?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, do you want to take a walk?
Sure. Yeah. See what we can do.
We head to a park down the block. The shelter's only allowed to operate at night, so a lot of people who sleep there spend their days in this park.
Is it okay if I join you on your blanket?
Sure.
Dave and Charles are a married couple, and they've been homeless for about 3 years. Dave says Charles is HIV positive, and he himself has survived 3 strokes.
The people here are accommodating, you know. Meg has seen me go off in a couple of times, but they do their best to keep it clean. We have sharps receptacles, you know, because it's needed.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Why is it important for the community to have a place where there aren't barriers for people with addictions and where there aren't barriers for people who need to sleep with their partners or have a pet or those kind of things?
That's one of the important things of the shelter, is if someone comes to them and they're like just about ready to pop at the seams and they need to be brought back up to the surface, so to speak, they have Narcan for that. They also have a separate room to help those that have a medical need until, like tonight, the doctors will be coming, and they try to do what they can.
When Meg looks at these two men, she sees them differently than a lot of people would, as individuals who have led full lives.
Charles was a nurse, a CNA, and, you know, they've both just lived these amazing and productive lives. I just believe that we have a personal responsibility as a community to care for them.
That sense of responsibility is compelling Meg to work on opening a day shelter. It'd be a place where people like Charles and Dave could get a break from the rain and the cold. Meg expects she will once again get pushback, but she plans to persist no matter how many people tell her no. That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing, with help this week from Heba Fisher, Ali Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. Parker Miles Blohm helps with photos and videos, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can get the podcast of our show on iTunes and hear individual stories on the KNKX and NPR One apps, or on our website, knkx.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just search for KNKX Sound Effect. Be sure to tune in next week when our theme is Turning Point. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.